will start the meeting. We know that we don't have a quorum, but we know that the quorum usually arrives in the next 2 or 3 minutes if we're stand to normal procedure. And we found out this morning when we had the permanent school trust land topic in the K-12 policy committee that we had a lot of questions, a lot of good dialogue, and there is a very nice presentation to start with from our guests that I will have Representative Dietrich introduce.
Sure.
That I think we better get started because we have the whole time for this and we probably will need it. Before we start, and before I turn it over to Representative Dietrich, I just want to welcome Chair Wagenius from the Environment Finance Committee. And did the Representative Dietrich, maybe when you do your talking, you can tell us about this morning in GovOps and where the bill went to, because I know it's going to Environment Finance at some point. So I think I'll call on you at this point, but I wanted to say how honored we are to have Representative Wagenius with us. Thank you. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, too, am very honored to have Representative Wagenius in here today. And she, like you and every other chair, are extremely busy. And so to take an hour and a half out of her time to come here today, I think is really says something about her. And I appreciate it very much.
And Representative Dietrich, I'm going to butt in because I forgot to say something about you before I turned it over to you. And I already said this in Ed Policy, but it just occurred to me you weren't in Ed Policy.
No.
And so, members, I think we all owe a huge thanks to Representative Denise Dietrich, who's been our resident junkyard dog on the issue of the permanent school trust land and has been educating herself, putting in hours and hours on committees here in the legislature, traveling around the country, being a guest speaker on the topic. And like all of us, we've been wringing our hands about not having funding for schools, but she's actually been working on a way where we could get some if we could pass this legislation. So thank you so much for all that you have done, and for including inviting our esteemed guests here today. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would be remiss if I didn't say thank you to Representative Greiling. She has been extremely supportive in my whole adventure here, which I'm just going to touch on a few little pieces of this adventure here, because that's what it truly has been, is an adventure. But first of all, the bill before you was House File 3475, and this morning in GovOps we did a delete all amendment and changed the bill, and you do have the DE1 amendment with you, and you also have the original bill, and you also have the most current bill brief. So look for, when you're looking at your bill briefs, make sure that you're looking at today's dated bill brief. So next to the bill is going to environment policy, and I'm sure that this bill is going to continue to evolve as it did in government ops, which we welcome the comments, the bill improvement, as long as it continues to reach the end goal of what we are trying to do. And that is, of course, focus on being the best trustee of the lands from the that the DNR currently manage, in order to provide the maximum amount of funding to our schools. But anyhow, I just jumped forward and I didn't plan to do that. I want to talk. I'll go back to 3 years ago when Representative Greiling asked me to chair the School Trust Lands Work Group. I had no idea what the School Trust Lands were. And so we needed to begin our research. So we began by taking a tour of some of the school trust lands in northern Minnesota. After 10 years of studying education funding before I got to the state, I really had no idea that school trust lands existed. And I had no idea about the other pieces that go along with the school trust lands in between getting the school trust lands and getting the money to our schools. But in that trip, and my studying in the years afterwards, I learned a lot. And now for the past 3 years, having taken the trip, I have formulated some serious concerns about the management and the return on the investment of the school of the school trust lands in turn to the school districts of this state. I have concerns about some of the oversight that we are charged with as trustees of the state. I have realized that our state is not alone. There are many other states asking the same types of questions about the same types of issues. One state that has addressed their issues in a very prudent way is the state of Utah. They have reformed the management of their school trust lands, and their reforms have proven to be highly successful. Today we have the honor of the two, I'll call them workhorses and pioneers of the Utah reform efforts in this committee. Since House File 3475 is modeled after the model that they have developed after many years of working, I have asked them to come today to tell the Utah Trustlands story to our Finance Committee as a backdrop for my bill. But more importantly than my bill, what I hope that their story does today is I hope that it gives us hope and courage to reform the management and structure of our school's trust lands. I hope their story will enlighten us on how we can better fulfill our role and responsibility as trustees for the state when it comes to school trust lands, their management, and the money that goes to our schools. I hope that their story inspires us to take action on behalf of the beneficiaries of this state, those beneficiaries being the school children in the state of Minnesota. At this point, I would like to introduce Margaret Bird and Kevin Carter to the committee. But before I do, I want to tell you just a little bit about them. And their bios are in your packets, and I would really appreciate it if each one of you would pull them out and make sure that you at least peruse them. Their credentials are pretty impressive. Margaret Bird received a BA degree from Vanderbilt University in theoretical mathematics. She worked on her master's degree in urban planning, earned her MS in economics from the University of Utah, where she got sidetracked as she started working on school trust lands before completing her coursework for her PhD. She is currently employed by the Utah State Office of Education, works as a consultant for the University of Utah and Utah State University on school trust lands, and is the director of Children's Land Alliance Supporting Schools, which you will hear about more later. CLASS is a nonprofit alliance of education leaders in 22 states who annually come together to share information and to be trained as effective advocates for the productive use of the 45 million acres in school trust lands generated by Congress to support schools. Then on her left is Kevin Carter. Kevin is the director of the Utah School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration. And he leads all of the activities of that agency. Originally, he was appointed to fill the unexpired term of his predecessor in 2003, and he has subsequently served as an additional four-year term, as was appointed in July 2009 for the second four-year term. As director, Carter has also serves on the State of Utah Constitutional Defense Council, the Board of Utah Geological Survey, the Natural Resources Coordinating Council, the Utah Generated Renewable Energy Electricity Network Authority Board, and recently assumed the chairmanship of the Utah Partners for Conservation and Development. And I could go on about some of the other committees, but I think I am going to stop here. But he has 25 years of experience in the management of school trust and trust lands, and he has pioneered the shift in the Utah trust land operations from a traditional resource management activities to a high return land use enterprises on the trust lands. So with that, I will turn it over to our guest speakers. Welcome and thank you.
And I believe, thank you, Representative Dietrich. If it's like this morning, we start with Ms. Bird, right?
Yes.
Okay, welcome and please give us your testimony.
But we'll do it a little bit differently than this morning because we don't have to say it in 30 minutes or less.
Right.
thank you very much, Madam Chair, for this opportunity to speak to you. We are so pleased over the success we've had in Utah, and we're so thrilled to have the opportunity to share with you this success. It far exceeds anything I could ever imagine. I remember I had a large party at my home, after we first created the School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration. And about 2:30 in the morning, when I finished cleaning up and putting the silver away and all from the large party and went to bed, I remember this knot in my stomach that said, my goodness, we've spent over a decade making this reform happen. What if it doesn't really make money like we thought it was going to? And I have to tell you that Kevin Carter and his predecessors have so far exceeded our expectations. It's absolutely incredible. The permanent fund in Utah has gone from $18 million a year when I first started working on it on behalf of the State Office of Education in 1983 to over $1 billion today. And it has been incredible. I want to make sure you understand that each new state, other than the original 13 colonies, received school trust lands at the time of statehood. And the original colonies gave themselves school lands when taxes weren't paid on lands and they came back to the state. So originally, there were 134 million acres in our country to support our schools. That's how important the Founding Fathers felt this issue was. I'm sad to report to you that today, you and Mississippi are the most eastern of the states that still have a remaining trust. And the other states have lost, the majority of states in our nation have lost all of their school trust lands and all of their funds. We believe that's a cautionary tale to those of us who still have school trust lands to support our schools. CLASS was formed, and that's the Children's Land Alliance Supporting Schools, which is a bit of a mouthful. CLASS was formed about a decade ago. Because as we worked on the issue in Utah, and as we worked on land exchanges as an education community, when we needed help from New Mexico or from Arizona or from Texas, and we would call those states, people would say, I'm sorry, you're mistaken. We don't have any of those kind of lands in our state. When we first formed CLASS, I recall calling the PTA president in New Mexico and saying to her, we would like for you to come to a conference to learn more about the school trust lands in New Mexico. And she said to me, you are mistaken. We don't have any school trust lands. And I said, no, you are mistaken. It's funding one-third of your entire education, because it was on that particular year, in the state of New Mexico. And she said, well, I'm not too sure about you, lady. I've never heard of you before. I'm going to check this out. So she went and started talking to people. And I got a phone call the next morning, and she said, how fast can I sign up? And she's been to all of our conferences ever since and very involved. Last year at our conference, we were pleased to have as one of our speakers your representative, Dietrich, and she had the same impact on the people in CLASS that she's had on you. She really energized some states that were becoming mired in this big issue that they couldn't quite decide how to move forward on. And so we were so grateful to you for loaning her to us for that conference. It was wonderful. CLASS was formed 10 years ago. There are now 22 states that have members in CLASS, and we gather a great deal of information about each of those states. So I thought I would begin this afternoon and go through some of that information. Let's go to the first slide. This is this shows you, and we put everybody else in black and gray, and put Minnesota in the colors, so that you can see exactly how much land you have in terms of your surface ownership and in terms of your mineral ownership. So you can tell from that slide, you're in the middle of the pack, or maybe the bottom of the upper half in terms of how much land you have left. That is very exciting. I can tell you that states like Nevada are getting very engaged on the trust land issue in their state. They have only 3,000 acres left, but they were shortchanged a great deal of acreage. And so I believe they are starting to work on the issue with their congressional delegation to see if they cannot recover some of those lands that they should have been given but were not given at the time of statehood. Now, we'll next go to the slide that shows you the surface revenue. These are 08 figures. The 09 figures are being compiled, but were not compiled at the point that we came for this conference. This, the larger red column indicates your total revenue, and then the blue column is how much of your revenue came from surface activity, so that you can see relative to your overall revenue how much of it was coming from the surface revenue. And I don't know, given the fact that you have a lot of acreage, one would expect those numbers to be larger than they are. It's also the mineral revenue chart, and this shows you what percentage of the property was, what percentage of your revenue is coming in from minerals versus your overall revenue source there. None of us can really compete in terms of minerals with Texas and New Mexico and their oil and gas that they have in those two states. There was one piece of information that I think was really quite interesting. Let's move to the next slide. A study was done in 1905 by a Dr. Swift at Columbia University. And at that point, he went back to look at where were the permanent funds in every single state in the nation as of 1905. He concluded some very disheartening things from looking at the data that he was looking at a century ago. And it was that he said, these permanent funds have been embezzled, swindled, breached in so many ways that he was gravely concerned with what was going to happen after that. And that was 1905. It is now, his research is now published in a book. If anyone is interested, or if you would like for me to copy the pages that have to do with Minnesota, I'd be more than glad to send that to you if you just provide me your card so I can get that information to you. But the thing that to me is very telling in this is when you look at the size of the permanent fund in Minnesota in 1905, you were second largest up there. Only Texas is ahead of you, and as we recall our history, Texas came into the Union as an independent republic, and so they came in on a little different terms than the rest of us. The federal government, there were no federal lands in Texas, so the federal government was unable to grant lands in Texas for the schools. So Texas granted itself lands, and then a number of years later decided they didn't grant enough, and they went back and granted more. So Texas has about 13 million acres of mineral rights, but only a small amount of surface. And I don't know, we have to go back to that. They're mostly coastal. But the thing that was telling to me on this is that you were so far ahead of the pack in 1905 in terms of building that permanent fund. The permanent fund, we've done a considerable research into the permanent funds. Our permanent fund in Utah was so poorly managed when we first began that the statutes required the state treasurer to invest the permanent fund for liquidity. And this is in a permanent fund. So in other words, it had to be where they could just get that cash as fast as they needed it. And that's exactly what happened. We had a number of raids on our permanent fund that at some point in the future, our legislature is going to have to repay those losses to that fund. But the other problem that we had is, as we talked to our state treasurer Ed Alter about it, we were very concerned because there was no mechanism for being able to invest that fund as an endowment fund. Now, if you have a permanent school fund, that should be managed as other endowment funds of the large universities, of your state universities that have large endowment funds. It should be managed by the smartest money managers that you can put in charge of that money. One of the conclusions from Dr. Swift was that it was the reason he thought the other 26 states had lost their permanent funds in 1905 was because they put the responsibility for investing that fund with people who already had full-time jobs, such as state treasurers, governors, other people who were elected for other main reasons, who kept their focus on the other things. And he felt like that the trust fund should be invested as an endowment fund, as you would want to do if you were leaving, if you have hundreds of millions of dollars and you wanted to be sure to leave that safely for your children and grandchildren. And that's what you're dealing with here, is a permanent fund. Your permanent fund is $612 million, I think, was the latest figure that we saw from Representative Dietrich. But those funds need to be invested so they give you a high return. I believe that this committee has the same material that was passed out in other committees. Is that correct, Representative?
Yes.
And so when you look at the page that's on your permanent fund, you can see that the returns that you were receiving during the 10 best economic investment years the nation has ever known are not very high. And if it makes you feel better, I can tell you that Mississippi is lower than your return. But there, and other than 2 years that I can think of in Washington State, the other funds have all returned immensely more revenue to their schools, higher percentage than what is occurring right now in Minnesota. That's easy money. It's not money that comes from taxes. It is money that just comes from investing prudently and profitably. I am not, and I really want to emphasize this here, I'm an economist, I am not advocating investment of that permanent fund in any type of imprudent investment. You know, risk and return are related, and we're not talking about that, but we're talking about prudent investment where perhaps for the same level of risk that you're experiencing right now, you could be receiving a higher return, much more like what is received in endowment funds. I understand that your state retirement fund receives maybe twice what you've been getting on your permanent school fund. So those are things that you may want to look into. In Utah, when we began this process, and when I say we, I want to make sure that it's really clear to you that I am talking about the education community as a whole. So this was an issue in which everyone in the education community joined hands. The State Office of Education, the State School Board, the local school boards, our education association, our teachers' union, our parent-teacher association, our principals' associations, all banded together and said, we don't believe we can do any worse than what we have been doing in Utah. We had been gathering information. I had been doing research, and a number of other people in those groups had been doing research, and what we found was we had a situation in our state where almost any issue you looked at, we were the worst. So if you wanted a poster child on how to make the least amount of money on grazing, Utah was there. We were there. We had on coal leasing, we had coal leases that were not reviewed in a timely manner. We had royalty that was paid way below market value, way below what the leases themselves required. We went to court on that and recovered $21 million. Every issue that we looked at, we were the worst. So at that point, we started looking at how are we going to make a difference. And in our state, we passed some legislation, mainly through the pushing of the state PTA, to have a task force look at it for 2 years. And for 2 years, this task force met over and over to hear how things were going in Utah and what did the rest of the country do that seemed to be so much better than what we were doing. At the conclusion of that, we were ready to go forward with something that was very close to the School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration that Kevin is the director of. However, we had a brand new governor. He had been in office less than 30 days. when the legislation had passed the House and was ready to go to the Senate, and our governor came to us and said, this bill is 120 pages long. And we said, we're aware of that, Governor. We've been trying to meet with you to share the information on the bill with you. And he said, well, I have to go out of town tonight, and the bill's going to hit the Senate in the morning. I can't read 120 pages tonight and absorb it. And he said, I'd like to study it one more year. Well, you know those magical numbers about how many votes you need in the House and how many votes you need in the Senate and how many votes you need from the governor. We decided the prudent thing to do was to study it one more year. So we had a citizen group composed of people from the environmental community, people from the mining, oil and gas, ranching communities, study it one more year. And at that point, at the end of that study, the basic bones of what we were proposing to do was exactly the same thing we had proposed the year before from the legislators. But this time the governor was ready to sign it. And we created this School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration. And I will admit to enormous amounts of fear. What if we went to this much political flashing of wrist or whatever you want to call it? And what if it doesn't make money? But it has so far exceeded our wildest dreams on what kind of revenue it will make. You know, if you don't try something, you don't ever know what it's going to do. But it has been wonderful. We also felt like in Utah, I know you are a group of people concerned with education finance. In Utah, the school trust land money went into our big education pot. And no one could point. I remember one year where right on June 30th, we had an extra $5 million come in from an investment that Merrill Lynch will never make that kind of investment opportunity again. But we did make $5 million on that day. And so I wanted to make sure, where did that go? How did it help our schools? No one could follow the paper trail. No one could tell me one thing that our education community benefited from. I'm still dubious on whether it really went to education. And at that point, we knew we had to make some changes. If this was going to be successful, we had to change how the money flowed. So we created something called the School Land Trust Program. And Mel Brown, the legislator in Utah who had made the changes to create the School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration, who is also the legislator who had worked to change the investment of the permanent fund, was the one that said, we want committees in every single school. We call them school community councils. We want a majority of parents elected by the parents. We want teachers elected by the teachers and the principal to look at the scores in their own school, to look at the environment in their own school, and decide what is our most pressing academic need in this particular school. And then they developed a plan to take that money and then use it to address that issue. It has had an incredible impact in Utah because suddenly everyone all over our state, it wasn't somebody in Salt Lake telling them what they were going to do. It was every little local community deciding, what do we need in our school that we don't currently have to improve education? All those, I don't know how many of you are former teachers, but I can remember as a former teacher, there were times when I would think, oh, I just wish I had money to buy whatever it was to implement it in the math classes that I taught. But there were no funds to do that with. This is discretionary money that every school gets. It is entirely transparent. It's a paperless system. It's all on the web. So the school enters their plan on the web. The local school board can't see it when the school first submits it, because the local school board wants to see it and approve it before they want to receive phone calls on something that might not be appropriate in the plan. But once it's approved by the local school board, then you can see that. You can see exactly how much money there is in there. A parent that might say, hey, every year we spend the money on science lab, and I think we need a math remediation program. well, then that parent can run for that school community council and try to help make that difference. We also show a DVD in every single school community council every single year that reminds them how the money, you know, where the money comes from, how it's invested by the state treasurer, and how it gets to their school. We used to not know at all. No one knew that the state treasurer was investing this money, and no one knew how much money it was. If you don't think they're watching, they are watching now, because that school knows the amount of money they get is dependent on how well the treasurer invests it. And they call the state treasurer. I spoke with him last week, and I said, I am tired of fielding calls from people that want to know how big the permanent fund is. You've got to put it on your website, because they're out there and they're looking all over your website, and you don't have it on your website. And so he said, yes, ma'am, we'll take care of that. So they will. We also provide a stamp so that if books are purchased with the trust land money, then they can stamp the books. We don't. We have stickers also that says this item was purchased with your dividends from the school trust. We put stickers on everything except the teachers. But this money does, it does buy teachers' aides, and it does buy professional development for the teachers and things of that nature. We don't expect the teachers to wear the stickers all day that are funded from this, but it does incredible things in our schools. And it's bringing people into the public schools, and I understand you have charter schools from going to your website. Our charter schools are public charter schools. It also provides money in those public charter schools. But every school knows how much money they get, and they know where it goes. And it's built a wonderful feeling that we're all in it together on trying to improve our schools, parents and teachers and the principal. It has also been an excellent learning experience for parents who came into the school and went, how are you teaching biology with only half your microscopes working? Had one doctor that was on a school community council tell me, well, the council decided to spend the money on reading, but when I saw the science supplies, I was so horrified that he went around to all the doctors in the community and said, give me all your old microscopes, but before you give them to me, get them in working order, and that's on your dime, and then I'm collecting them. And then he brought them to the school, and the school had what they needed. We had another parent that said, I work for the Attorney General's office, and we could use about 3 or 4 more computer labs at our school, but we don't have the computers for them. We have the wiring, but we don't have the computers for that. And he said, the Attorney General's office in our state is surplusing all of their computers and going to a new one. And so he collected 120 computers from the Attorney General's office and took them over to the school, and then they had the lunch lab. That wasn't funded with the school land trust program, but it was because that parent sat on that committee and began to be aware of all the needs that the schools had that weren't being met. So it has been a fabulous program for us. I think every state in class, someone said to me, well, do you have best practices models at class? And I said, we don't, because every state has got to tailor things for what works in their state. I think it would be very presumptuous of us in class to say, here is the model and everyone needs to conform to this one model. So what works in one state may not work in another state, because you've got different lands, different needs in that state. But I will tell you that having this money go so that people actually feel it in their local community has made an enormous difference. They also write letters, thank you letters, to their legislators to thank them for the money and let them know how they spent the money. So many of our Utah legislators say the only thank you letters I get are from school community councils. You know, I just get things that people are mad about. They're the ones who write me and call me. But it has made a tremendous difference in people supporting the legislature, because they're grateful for that money. So that's our Utah story, except for what happened with the school land trust program.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bird. Mr. Carter.
Good Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. You probably have received in some printed material a copy of a map that shows trust land ownership, or state land ownership in Utah. I'll just take a second, if I may, and explain a little bit about that map. We are in Utah 67% federally owned. And so that has a huge impact on our ability to generate revenue for public services, including the school system. On the map, the color code, yellow is Bureau of Land Management land, green is Forest Service, purple would be national forests, excuse me, national parks and national monuments, orange would be Native American reservations, pink would be defense depots and training areas, and then the blue that you'll see is small little scattered, if you'll notice, scattered throughout the state in what looks like a rash are the 1 square mile school sections that are throughout the state in a 4-section per township pattern. Utah, when it came into the union, received a 4-section grant. I know Minnesota had a 2-section grant. States that came in before Minnesota got 1 section in each township. It was a function of how fertile the land was as civilization progressed westward across the nation. Ohio and some of the early states in the very fertile Ohio Valley got the 1 section. Minnesota, I think, was one of the first 2-section states. It continued up through 1890 when Montana and the Dakotas came in and got 2 sections, and Utah was the first 4-section state, recognizing the arid nature of the Great Basin, where Utah and New Mexico and Arizona are located. The original grant was a surface grant only. It didn't include the mineral estate, which is why they only recognized surface productivity on there. The minerals actually came later to all of the states in the 1920s. The grant from the Congress was amended to include the mineral estate. And many states that had sold their trust lands, or some of them, the mineral estate passed through the state to the surface owner. That was certainly the case in Utah and most other states. Since the 1920s, any lands that we've sold, we've had to reserve the mineral estate by virtue of federal law and state law, as have all of the other states. And that's led to the situation where we have 3.5 million acres of both surface and mineral, and an additional 1 million acres where we only own the mineral estate. We've sold the surface. This graph presents the model for trust land management in Utah before 1994, when the change was made. There was an executive director of the Department of Natural Resources. He was a political appointee of the governor, actually was a cabinet position in the governor's cabinet. Within the Department of Natural Resources, there was a Division of State Lands and Forestry, Division of Wildlife Resources, State Parks, a regulatory agency, oil, gas, and mining, that regulated mining, Utah Geological Survey, water resources and water rights, all the traditional natural resource agencies. They were part of the Department of Natural Resources. The director of the Division of State Lands and Forestry was appointed by the executive director of the Department of Natural Resources, and essentially it was with the pleasure of the governor. There was no question that the executive director wasn't going to appoint somebody that the governor didn't want. He served at the pleasure of the executive director. There was a state land board, but they didn't have management authority. They were a policy board and were kind of offline as far as line authority went. All of the revenues that were generated from the Division of State Lands and Forestry should have gone to the Permanent School Trust Fund, but it was obvious that a portion of it was being spent to manage the administration of the state forestry program and other land management programs in the state. The employment model was patterned after federal land management agencies, after the Forest Service and the BLM, and the focus was essentially the same as federal land management. Multiple use, any activity that took place was given equal weight, and any revenues generated were given to whoever was the person or the entity that took responsibility for them, instead of focused on schools. And the employees, like I say, were all civil service employees, similar to other state and federal employees. That changed in 1994. They created the Trust Lands Administration. The Trust Lands Administration, in the vernacular of the Utah Code, is a quasi-independent state agency, which means that although we are a part of the executive branch, we are not under the control of the governor's office. And so there is a board of trustees, and this board of trustees is composed of 7 members. One member is appointed by the governor at large. He can appoint anyone he wants. Usually it's been somebody from his staff. This person serves as the conduit between the governor's office and the administration for important instructions and requests to go both ways. The other 6 members of the board are also appointed by the governor for rotating 6-year terms, but they are appointed. The appointment must be made from a short list that the governor gets from a nominating committee. And this nominating committee usually submits 2 names to the governor, and they interview candidates. They look for candidates who meet certain qualifications. Do they have an educational background in mineral development or forestry or one of the other business models that we're involved with? And so they look for people that have that expertise instead of people who might be important county commissioners or have other important political connections. The Board of Trustees then is tasked with setting policy for the agency, setting the agency's budget, and for selecting the director. So as the director, I'm appointed by the Board of Trustees for a 4-year term. Although technically it is a 4-year term, I do serve at the pleasure of the Board of Trustees. I'm sure if I do not perform to their satisfaction, they'll find a way to accelerate my retirement. The focus of the agency was modified substantially, and they told us to act like a business and not like government. And so we changed our focus. The majority of the employees were given the option of changing from a civil service type of model to a private business at will model. And to date, all of the professional people in the agency have made that choice to do that. So the majority of our employees are at will. Now, we had to offer them a financial inducement to give up the protections that were in the civil service system and go with an at-will position. But they believed that it was worth it, and they were comfortable with the idea that their jobs would be secure if they performed. And it's proven to be that way. We divided the agency into 4 main working groups, one that deals with our oil and gas assets, one with coal and other minerals, one with surface activities, and one with our real estate program. And then we have support people who do accounting and legal work and that type of action for us, auditing. And so that's the model that we have right now. The Utah Supreme Court has ruled several times on trust land management in Utah, and the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled on trust land management from several of the states, Arizona and Montana probably being, and Oklahoma, excuse me, being some of the most important ones. But essentially, they have determined that when Congress offered these lands to Utah in our Enabling Act, and when Utah accepted them in our state constitution, it created a trust, just like you would create a trust for your children or grandchildren with a bank or with a law firm to manage assets that you had wanted to leave for them. The same idea. And that this trust imposed upon the state of Utah a duty of fidelity and to provide an undivided loyalty. and to provide for the financial benefit of the beneficiaries. And they were clear that it was the financial benefit they were focusing on. Some people might argue that's important for school children to have open space, and I won't dispute that. I think it is also. But that's not what these lands are about. They're not to provide open space for children. They're to provide revenue for the school system. Since 1994, when we were created, this chart will portray our revenue streams. If you wanted to extend this chart from 1994 back in time to 1974 or 1964, you would have seen a column that pretty much stayed in the same place. It would have oscillated between $10 to $20 million a year for the 20 or 40 years before that. Since that time, you can see what's happened with revenues. Ms. Bird talked about our permanent trust fund. The permanent fund started to accrue revenues in 1898, 2 years after statehood, when the land office was set up and started to sell land and lease land. It grew from statehood over the course of 100 years to be about $50 million. So from 1898 to 1998, 96 thereabouts, $80 to $100 million maybe. Since that time, I'm pleased to report that as of December 31st of 2009, the permanent fund balance was $1,029,000,000. So we crossed the billion-dollar threshold at the end of last calendar year. Several things have contributed to that, but probably the main one is a change of focus and a recognition that these lands should be managed exclusively for the financial benefit of the school children. In addition to focusing on generating revenue for the schools, we also take seriously our obligation to be stewards over the land. One of the assets that we have on our lands in Utah are our cultural resources. For example, this spectacular petroglyph, which is called the Great Hunt or the Hunter Panel. It's on a piece of school trust land in eastern central Utah. It's world famous, a world-class petroglyph. It is situated on this rock wall immediately adjacent to a road. It was so close to the road that wide mirrors on a pickup truck could scratch it as they went by. We worked in conjunction with an oil company, with some county friends, and with the cultural archaeological community to relocate the road, to develop this site in such a way that the public could still enjoy it and appreciate it. Enjoy it and appreciate it, but have it protected. We have no trouble in pursuing these types of activities and continuing to pursue our mandate to generate revenue for the school system. I just have such a fun time with this petroglyph, because down in the bottom right of this thing, I'm sure that one is the Kool-Aid Man. Look at that. Anyway. Other stewardship issues that we deal with: endangered species. Plants, animals under the Federal Endangered Species Act are protected regardless of who owns the land. Plants are only protected on federal land. In order to provide protection to plants, we generally try to find somebody else to own the property, because we're not the best people in the long term to own endangered species habitat. But one of the things that we've concluded is that if you are willing to both look for ways to protect the species and fulfill your mandate, you can probably find it. This is the Utah prairie dog, an endangered species that occurs only in three counties in southern Utah. It was impeding development of a community down there. Essentially, all development had come to a standstill because it would impinge upon the habitat of this species. So we went out and we found replacement habitat on school trust land. We prepared the habitat so that it would be acceptable to the animals and to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And then we made available that land for transplant of the prairie dogs. And so a homeowner who had a prairie dog on their property or a developer could come in, they could make arrangements to have the dogs transplanted into this preserve we had created for a price. They would pay us, we would allow this to happen. They would receive clearance from the Fish and Wildlife Service to develop their property. The going rate was about $2,000 per dog. Right there. But
and the school kids have laughed all the way to the bank.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, we satisfied the environmental issues, we satisfied our trust mandate, and we are convinced that if you are sincere and you want to make your trust obligations comport with your stewardship obligations, you can do so. We have sensitive lands in Utah. This is what I mentioned before. This is what the boundary waters will look like in a million years if it doesn't get any more water. You have a hard time getting a perspective on the size of this arch from this picture, but if you go to Moab, Utah, near where this is at, in restaurants there, you'll see pictures of this arch on the wall with an airplane flying through it. It is a big arch. Some people refer to it. Excuse me?
A 747.
No.
Yeah, a small plane.
No, it wasn't a 747.
It's not a small plane, but nonetheless. There's no question that we are not the best people to own all pieces of property with our mandate. And so we look for ways to get this into the hands of people who are better situated to own it. The advantage of being in a perpetual long-term trust is that I don't have to put every piece of property on the market today. I have 3.5 million acres that I manage. A number of those acres are off the table and they're backburnered while I work on the properties that I can prudently make money from. These properties are waiting for the right person to come along, be it the federal government or some other entity like the Nature Conservancy, to own these lands and will acquire other lands that have income potential alternatively. I think that presents most of the major part of my presentation. I'd be glad to answer any questions now, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. We'll spend the rest of the time asking questions, but I just want to see, at this point anyway, is there anyone, we don't have the bill in our possession, but is there anyone who wants to testify on the bill? Okay, then we can have good time for questions. And Representative Anzels has got the first one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't really want to ask the testifiers any questions. But I would like to remind the members of the committee that most, if not all, of these sections 16 and 36 are in northeast Minnesota. And since 1857, with the Enabling Act, in theory, the wealth from these sections derived from the people of northeastern Minnesota in timber, iron ore, and taconite, and hopefully non-ferrous mining if you allow it, has been shared with your school district. And so the rush to judgment here with this legislation, I would ask that you temper some of this a little bit so that in making changes, if that is what the outcome becomes, that you understand that it is the development of these sections that has brought you the wealth in the first place. So I hope you'll balance the development with your needs to fund the educations of our school children, and again to underscore, the poorer people in the poorer districts of northeastern Minnesota are sharing with you all.
Thank you, Representative Anzels, and for our guests, you can guess Representative Anzels is from way up north in the International Falls area. Which
the
is
only there. Member of the committee north of Highway 2.
Which is very far north. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm interested a little bit in the history of all this, and we just had Representative Anzels indicating that most of these trust lands now are in the northern part of the state. I came originally from the southern part of the state, and of course we had sections set aside for the schools. Historically, how did the states lose all those, or what was the permutations that were going on as these states would make the decisions to sell off these lands? And generally, they just simply used the resources to take care of the schools at that time, and then when they ran out, there was no more? Or did they use it for other purposes? I suppose there was a mix of reasons.
Ms. Bird?
Okay. Madam Chair and committee, the reasons the other states lost these lands vary somewhat by state. In the South, you had a situation where when the South seceded from the Union, they converted the money in their permanent funds to Confederate dollars, which later became wallpaper in homes. And so that's primarily how the Southern states lost theirs. Northern states lost a lot of their lands just through embezzling the fund, through legislatures not paying attention to it, not paying attention to how it was invested. I think that some of the states in the West have lost some of their school lands because there's been a tendency to call these lands state lands and then act like they belong to everyone in the state instead of acting like they belong to the schools. And so then you didn't have people. That was our problem in Utah. They called them state lands. We finally said, okay, no one else is allowed to use the term state land. We want to hear school trust land or school lands, period. And I will admit to having interrupted the governor a number of times, point out to him that the term is not state land and it doesn't belong to the state. The state is the trustee with those full obligations to act in the best interest of the school children. So that has been a problem. Many states initially at statehood, and that's how Nevada lost all of their lands. They're down to 3,000 acres, and they lost those primarily because Nevada is the most arid state in the nation. When they were given the scattered school sections, they realized they were going to have a hard time generating revenue from the two sections that they had because some of them had no water on them at all. And so they asked if instead of getting the two sections, if they could get half as much land and they could select it where they wanted to. So Las Vegas, Reno, Carson City are all built on all school, former school trust lands. However, being the most arid state in the nation, they should have been given four sections instead of two sections. And so there is a movement afoot right now in the state of Nevada to go back and say federal government. We're 87% federal government in the state of Nevada. We feel that we have been shorted by several million acres. You will need to provide those to our state on the equal footing doctrine. So that's how it was lost. But when you read Dr. Swift's book on the permanent fund, you also see that there were a lot of improper actions going on, money being taken out of that fund just to meet budget shortfalls, water rights being given away for a dollar. Just about any way someone can take money.
Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And a little follow-up. We just heard a little discussion of the fact that in the state of Minnesota now, the school trust lands are all located in a particular part of the state. And so this will lead to conflict discussion about what ought to be the use of these funds at the present. Do you have a similar situation in Utah? And if so, how did you deal with that political issue of one section of the state still having these areas and the rest of the state not? And how did you convince one or the other section to see it as a state fund for all kids, not just for a particular area.
We did deal with that issue in Utah. Because it took us 50 years to get statehood, we had a lot of land that was already settled. And so basically the Salt Lake Valley and the valleys that head south from there all were settled, and therefore we did not get school trust lands in there to begin with. What lands we did get were in large part sold to early settlers. And we basically have our school trust lands, with the exception of St. George, Utah, which was one of the nation's fastest growing areas of the country. It's kind of like an oasis down in the southern part of the state. With the exception of that, most of our school lands are out scattered throughout the rural portions of the state. So we have had people saying, well, wait a minute, why isn't all this money just going to the rural schools instead of the urban schools also? Well, it does go to the urban schools now. And we've had to work very hard at helping people understand this trust concept. These lands were granted in trust for all the children that were school children in that state, not just the example of where they were located. In Washington County, which is where St. George is, the Trust Lands Administration was approached by the superintendent, who said, well, there's this valuable piece of school trust lands, but I need a place to park my school buses. So I want to park them for free on the school trust lands. And our response was, the children all over the state own that piece of property. You're welcome to park your school buses there, but I would choose a spot that was a lot lower rent than that, because that spot was a very high rent area. So as people begin to understand the trust concept, I think that helps in the explanation of, because our lands are more in one area than another area. But I think that also, because we develop these school lands, it provides jobs in those areas. I think the engine that's created by the school land trust school and institutional trust lands administration is one of our key components to economic development in our state.
Hey, we have three Thank people you. On the list, and I have some questions as well. We'll next is Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you were listing the categories from which you obtain your revenue, you listed four. I wrote down three. One was oil and gas, one was coal, one was real estate, and there was a fourth. What percentage of money do you get from each of these categories?
Mr. Carter.
Yes, Madam Chairman. The four categories, as you've mentioned, there's oil and gas, and most of our money comes from that.
Most, as in how much?
65 to 75%, probably year in, year out. Coal and hard rock, which would be 10 or 15%. And then, depending on the year, but typically real estate and then surface.
And real estate would be how much? What percent?
Mr. Carter.
It's really dependent upon the year. It could be as much as in the best years, it rose to about a quarter of the revenue. This is not a best year this year, and it's substantively below that now. But the surface revenues have stayed fairly constant, and that would be things from grazing and forestry, land sales, rights of ways.
And what percentage is that?
Representative Venus.
Yeah, probably 10%. Yeah, in an average year.
So are you then responsible? I mean, we don't have oil and gas, we don't have coal, and the real estate's fairly dubious given the area we're in. We do have the surface and forestry. Do you then pay all the expenses of forest management out of this account?
Yes.
Mr. Carter.
And
Representative Guineas.
And what it would be helpful to have those numbers to us. It managing forestry in Minnesota is a very expensive proposition for our general fund. So it would be helpful to know some figures, maybe
sure.
a few chairs later.
Madam Chairman, Chairwoman, I can respond in a general sense. I pay very close attention to each of the programs that we administer, and all of them are revenue producing. I don't have any programs that cost more to operate than we earn from them. Forestry is not a big money maker in Utah simply because we don't have the forest resources that northern states have. But we have some. And during typical years, I would say it's probably $2 to $3 earned for every dollar spent.
We're not close to that.
Is what the forest program will generate.
Rep. Rukavina.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you for letting me sit in on your committee on an issue, members, that and Rep. Gaines and I are classmates, and this is an issue that I've been dealing with for 24 years and have been totally ignored. And I'm glad to see it coming. And I told Representative Dietrich when she started on this quest a couple of years ago that she will be totally ignored for the next 24 years. And the reason why is because we won't take the bold steps that Utah took to get us here. Representative Wagenius, your line of questioning is kind of interesting. And Representative Benson, the school trust has to give money equally to every school child in the state. That's the way we've interpreted it, although in Utah, they have given smaller districts a little more money to capital. And evidently, we have that leeway. But let me tell you my experience. And first of all, we'll talk about 16 and 36, because those sections were sold off as the agricultural state that we are moved, you know, towards the north. And Representative Anzels, you're not totally correct in that they're mostly in the northeast. There's still quite a bit of school trust land in north central and even a little bit in the northwest.
90% northeast.
Well, I don't know if it's that high, but I won't argue with you. You and I argue in private all the time, but we don't do it publicly. And you know, so the current pot of money, which I think, helped me out, Mr. Strom or Crow, maybe is $600-700 million. I'm not sure what it is now.
They're shaking their heads, yes, for the record.
It's basically made up of this. 80% of the money has come from mineral wealth, 14% from timber, and at least the last time I checked, and 6% from all the land we sold. But the abuse of the fund has been phenomenal. So when I got here, I was asked to put on an amendment by my housemate, former Representative Lona Min, asked me in government operations to put a little amendment on a bill, which she just said, do this, it's nothing. That afternoon, I had Representative Bob McCarron, who chaired the Education Policy Committee then, who was a wild man, because he makes me look like an altar boy, so God rest his soul. And that time, the Policy Committee controlled the Finance Committee. And Representative Ken Nelson from Minneapolis was the Finance Chair. And they were threatening me by the time we walked over to the House floor that I had done this terrible, terrible thing. And all I did was offer an amendment that said that the school trust lands where there were cabins in northeastern Minnesota on school trust land, mostly owned by Iron Range and rural residents from, well, not Marquardt's district, but I would say Representative Ward's district and a few others maybe here, that we were going to sell them. Because what had happened is a DNR assistant commissioner, whose name will go unmentioned, had tried to get one of these cabins or had a friend that tried to get them and saw what the lease payments were on these school trust lands on Lake Vermilion and some of your lakes over there, and said they're not paying their fair share. So the DNR had basically abused the system and raised it to the point where the lease for a school trust cabin on a lake where these people had grubbed the stumps and bought the gravel and put the roads in to make it was twice as much as their neighbor who owned the cabin was paying in taxes. So we decided we'd take the legal route and go to an auction, because this assistant commissioner or deputy commissioner had got a neighbor who had a school kid to bring a lawsuit that the school trust was being abused because these mostly rural residents were not paying their fair share. Now, at the same time, the Department of Natural Resources was cutting $3 to $4 million worth of timber a year from 1980 to 1991, and this is the same time period, putting $0. For 11 years, they sold $3 to $4 million worth of timber and put zero in the trust fund. But our constituents, Representative Ward, were abusing the system. It went to court. It kind of, I don't know what happened in the court case. Maybe Mr. Strom's been around long enough to remember some of this. So I started doing a little research on this. And, you know, I found out who was really abusing the system. And the abuse is not, you know, a few old-timers that grubbed the stumps and poured the gravel and built the roads and then had to buy this land. And by the way, the way they wrote the law was, if the land was appraised at 40 grand and the cabin was appraised at 40 grand, but somebody in auction bid up the land to 250,000, the person got the 40 grand, paid the 40 grand for the cabin, but the other 200,000 went to the state. This is what we
want. Representative Rookreen, I'm just going to give you a time check. We conclude at 4:15 and we have questions for these out of state visitors.
But I have to tell them. So I looked through the whole system, and
if
I put
in
a bill
up
to
in like one more minute
to trade the land in the boundary waters, but it never went anywhere, and it's still sitting there. And the environmentalists in Minnesota said that Willard would always say that the land was worth more than money, and that you can't sell the land. And I agreed to that. But then when we tried to trade the land in the boundary waters for twice or three times as much land with the federal government in the Superior National Forest, all of a sudden they said that money was more valuable than land. But if you look at the income of the fund, 80% from minerals, where we still own the mineral rights and the land, 14% from timber, and only 6% from the sale of the land, it doesn't hold water. So I've tried to do this, but as long as Gene controls the purse strings of the management of the fund and the Environment Committee, and the DNR is still taking money out, which now there's so many questions that are unanswered, you will never fix this. And you know, this fund could be worth billions of dollars, and a good example is what happened this year, Madam Chair, and then I'll just shut up. But you know, we just bought 5 miles of beautiful shoreline on Lake Vermilion because we had to have this beautiful 5 miles next to 5 miles. We already own a beautiful shoreline, which we've never done nothing with the state park that's there. We own 25 miles of really beautiful shoreline, the school trust, when we traded in that trade for those cabins. The DNR, that was in 1998 that the deal, I think, was consummated. The 25 miles of shoreline is sitting on Lake Vermilion generating, oh, you guessed it, zero to the trust fund. Why didn't we buy 5 miles of shoreline from the school trust instead of 5 miles of shoreline U.S. Steel? You know why? Because we can keep abusing the kids. And so until this is transferred to an independent agency, or until the parents of this state understand that every kid in this state is getting $26 to $40 a head, and we make a special fund that goes to, like they do in Utah, a group of parents and school administrators or school board members from Minneapolis or Champlain or Nashua, Keewatin, and they get the same amount, the $26, and there's a strings attached saying, this comes to you from the school trust of the state, and you can do with it what's best for your school district. Until, if that happened, I can guarantee you that the DNR will not be managing those timber sales and those trust lands a decade down the road, because people will realize what their real purpose is and how important it is to the school kids of this state. And we own a lot of beautiful school trust land that's sitting there doing absolutely nothing.
Thank you, Representative Rukavina. And I take that as comments and testimonial for the bill. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think in Minnesota, if we manage these lands for maximum return, we'd have to really change our focus and how we look at these lands and what they're for. Did you have those problems as far as people saying we have to look at more of the stewardship area, or how do you balance that with maximum return?
Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. We recognize that there are some lands in our portfolio that we're not the best owner for, you know, because of their sensitivity or other issues that they need to be managed by somebody else. And so we have a very active land exchange program. We also have a very strong relationship with the Nature Conservancy and other conservation groups that purchase land, and they acquire land from us. And the reason that they come to the table and that the federal government comes to the table is that we have demonstrated that if we have to get satisfaction, we will put one of these pieces on the market and we will sell it. And they believe us now that we will do that. And so that has been an education process for many, many people in the state to come to grips with the idea that these, honest to goodness, are school trust lands, they're not public lands, and that they can have another purpose other than just sitting there. And if you don't want them to have that other purpose, you need to come to the table sincerely and realistically and deal with us on how to deal with those lands. And that has been a painful process, much more pain earlier than now, but still some pain now. We had a situation 2 years ago where a piece of property on a river in northern Utah that was prized for its fly fishing uses. Someone came in and wanted to purchase it. Actually, they wanted to develop a lodge on it. Mm-hmm. And we went down the process, and our Division of Wildlife Resources came forward and said, no, that'd be a terrible thing to do on this river. We've gone out of our way to purchase all of the other lands along this river so that nobody can do just what you're proposing to do. And we said, well, okay, instead of going on with this lease, we'll put it on the market, and if you feel that strongly about it, then come to the auction. And there were newspaper editorials and newspaper cartoons. There was one cartoon that had a picture of a guy who was titled Utah Resident. He was casting forward, and the line went forward, floated downstream, and came back around and was in his wallet, pulling his own wallet out of his back pocket for the citizens having to buy a piece of state property from a state agency. And so, like I say, the education process is not entirely completed, but the Division of Wildlife Resources understood, and they were there at the auction. They had rounded up a supporter with money who aided them, and they prevailed at sale. But rarely does it have to go to that extent. Usually we can find a way to resolve those issues, but we are not unwilling to go that route if that's the route we have to go, and everybody knows that we will.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carter, would you just touch on a little bit about the land swap that you just did with the federal government? I saw the newspaper article. It was one of the largest in U.S. history. Would you put that in context of the fact that we have a resolution that just passed the Senate that actually would, in principle, say that we are going to start that process again with the federal government of doing a hybrid land swap sale with the federal government for the school trust lands in the Boundary Waters Canoe area?
Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Representative. I'm going to divert just a teeny bit from your question and answer it based on a previous land exchange, because the one exchange that we just got authorization from Congress to pursue in August is a smaller one and is not as demonstrate the points as well as a previous one, which I think is the one that you're probably referring to, because it was the largest one. Mm-hmm. We conveyed about 400,000 acres and change to the United States, and we received about 180,000 acres plus $50 million in cash plus the revenue from two producing coal mines and two prospective coal mines, essentially the nuts and bolts of the deal. It took a long time to work that out. It took a long time in the Congress. It took a lawsuit after the Congress passed a bill. It took the president declaring a national monument that upped the ante by capturing an additional 200,000 acres of trust land through that process. But finally, after all of that history, and we were able to engage our governor to engage effectively with the Secretary of the Interior, at that time Secretary Babbitt, to work out something that was fair and equitable. Many of the lands that we had included in the land exchange were inside the national parks, and they had been captured over 60 years ago. And the federal government had stalled and stalled and done nothing and done nothing, quite frankly, because we hadn't done anything. We hadn't pushed the issue. Mm-hmm. So we finally started to push the issue. We went, our land board at that time asked the staff to go around to five or six places in the state and hold public hearings on the topic of commercial development on our lands within the national parks. Those were fun times, I can imagine. A lot of passion over that issue, but at least brought the issue to the forefront that we weren't going to sit back any longer and just ignore it. And so we pushed the issue and ended up, with the exchange that got the results that we wanted. The lands that we acquired in the exchange were oil and gas properties that have been very productive for us. We've been very fortunate with those. If I was going to do it in this climate and this economy, instead of taking the $50 million and putting it in the permanent fund, I'd use it to buy urban properties to develop and manage that way. We have an urban real estate program where we take some of our lands that happen to be in urban areas. We put our lands on the table through a competitive process. We select a partner that comes in who has the capital to do the infrastructure developments and run it through the county planning and zoning processes and get all the permits. We develop the land, sell the lots, and split the proceeds. In some cases, we develop commercial properties in conjunction with that, and we retain ownership of the commercial properties and lease them and have an ongoing revenue stream. I think if I had a $50 million check right now, I'd spend it that way rather than just depositing in the permanent fund. The beneficiaries may feel differently about that, but that's why you set up a trust, because you don't always trust the beneficiaries with their assets.
But you better listen to them.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. I have one more question. Since I have started down the path with this bill, the DNR and a couple of other people have said, how can you do that? What you're doing is duplicating effort. I'm not going to take the DNR and start duplicating what they do and then cost the whole state more and cost the school trust lands more. And so how do you respond to that that accusation?
Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. We chose, when we were separated from the Department of Natural Resources, we were given the option to contract with them for forestry work and other things, or to go to the private market and contract in the private market for those services. We chose to contract with DNR for the first couple of years. We then changed and contracted with outside entities, and now we've changed again. We kind of have a hybrid where we have some people on staff that we brought on, one person on staff, and the rest we contract with outside parties to do that. We've concluded that although certainly the professional foresters in our Department of Natural Resources were very competent people, their idea of forestry for income production was different than ours. They had a concept of forestry for a lot of other uses other than making money from trees. And they were excellent at doing that, and we didn't have any problem with that from that type of management, but we wanted to manage the small timber resources that we had for other purposes. And so that's the way we went. Every state already has duplication in land management. I would suspect that your Fish and Game Agency owns land and manages it themselves, and your state parks department probably owns land and manages it themselves. And so it's not a new paradigm that you peel off a portion of land that has a specific use and you ask somebody with specific expertise to manage that specifically. And so that's essentially what we had happened to us.
Okay, we have three more minutes, and no one in this committee has ever tried on that point before. So Representative Rukavina says he has a question on that point, and we'll see if you can ask it in like 15 seconds.
I won't ask it at all. I would ask Margaret to tell the story last night, because you see on your sheets probably the fact that there's an administrative fee, a management fee, an improvement fee, a fire protection fee by the DNR on your timberland. Mm-hmm. Tell the story quickly.
Okay.
And let me provide. This might be, Ms. Bird, the closing statement, because we do end on time, which will be in about 2.5 minutes.
Okay. Madam Chair and Committee, I do want to make sure that you understand one thing, and that is that of every dollar that is earned in the state of Minnesota, only 27 cents of that dollar goes to the schools, to the permanent fund. In Washington State, that manages lands and does all of the things that were referred to, and in Idaho, where all of those things are also done, they put into their permanent funds over 70 cents and keep 20-something cents. We did discover in Utah, we had an audit done prior to the split of the agency, and the records were not kept in such a way that the auditors could really, the legislative auditors could really get at some of the data they needed to get at. And they concluded that there was no subsidy going on. However, when the agency was split, they ended up realizing that the school children of the state of Utah had been subsidizing forestry activities in our state to the tune of $1 million a year. It was a very sad day to us, because when we thought about what $1 million could have been doing in our schools, children going without books, larger classrooms, teachers going without professional development training because that subsidy was going on. And so the Speaker of the House, who was also the sponsor of the bills that created the CITLA, indicated that they were going to have to go public, they were going to have to acknowledge that, and the subsidy was over.
Thank you very much. And members, there is a, for those of us like myself who didn't get my to ask my questions, or Representative Depke and others, there is a reception this afternoon and right before another meeting. So I think I'm going to ask Representative Dietrich to give us the details of that.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Margaret and Kevin will both be available actually after the committee today, and we are having a small little reception before the Permanent School Advisory Committee tonight, which starts at 6:30. So the reception is starting at 5:30. So if you wanted to come and talk with them personally and ask them your questions, you can spend some time. It is right outside room 200.
So it's outside room 200?
Yes, the reception. Right in the hallway there.
Okay. Thank you very much. And members, before we go away, I'm going to thank my guests in a minute, our guests in a minute, but I wanted to make sure we approve the minutes. So Representative Marquardt, the March 11th minutes?
So moved.
Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Thank you so much, and we'll continue this discussion at 5:30.
Thank you.